It's important to me because I think education, like healthcare, should be a universal right and not a privilege. And unfortunately, we all know this, I think. I don't think I'm going to get a lot of argument from anybody. Is that education is probably the fastest and most efficient way for people to change their income level.
Welcome to Level Up Your Course, where we pull back the curtain on what it takes to create learning that transforms lives. You will hear stories from business owners like you who share their success and their struggles. This is not where you come to hear passive income myths, friend. This is where you learn the truth about building a profitable learning platform. I am your host, Janelle Allen, and this is today's episode. What's up, everyone? I am your host, Janelle Allen, and today I am joined by Christo, CEO and founder of Blind, a brand strategy studio in LA. He also founded The Future, an education platform where creative professionals learn business principles. And he's here to talk about his story and his platform. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Janelle.
I'm really excited to talk with you. I stumbled upon your work via LinkedIn, of all places, because rarely there. And just kind of was obsessed with learning more about everything that you do. So before we get into the good stuff, we're going to kick off with the rapid five. Five quick questions to help listeners get to know you. You ready?
Okay. How rapid do I have to be?
Well, you know, it's moderately rapid. Yeah, you're good. I'm not going to grade you on speed or anything.
Okay.
All right. Number one, what did you have for breakfast?
A teaspoon of honey.
Very minimal. Okay. Number two, what is the last movie you saw?
I have to look into the box office. It's probably a superhero movie with my son. I'm sure of it.
Okay.
Just trying to figure out which one. Okay. Let me circle back to that one because I want to be accurate on that. Okay.
All right. Come back. Number three. This is a new question.
Okay.
The zombie apocalypse hits.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready for this
six.
One.
You've got six minutes to grab three essential items. Your family's okay, so you don't have to worry about picking them. What do you pick?
My notebook, my hard drive, my passport. That's it.
Okay. Number four, since I know that you wear a lot of hats, this one is especially for you. Fitted or snapbacks?
Snapback.
Okay. That's surprising. And number five, what is the hardest lesson you have learned as an entrepreneur?
The hardest lesson I've had to learn probably is how to manage people. Yeah, how to get them to do what they need to get done.
All right. So before we move on, what's that movie?
Oh, shoot. Honey, what's the last movie we saw together? The Girl and the Spider's Web.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's the movie I saw.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
Thanks, hon. She has a better memory than me.
All right. So I know that you live in LA and you went to college in Pasadena, but are you originally from the LA area?
No, I grew up in San Jose. And before that, I lived for a couple of years in Kansas City, Missouri.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you moved to San Diego, correct? Tell me how you got over to that whole California area.
Okay. How did I get to Southern California? Basically, I decided after graduating high school that I wanted to go to art school. And the best way for me to prepare my portfolio just happened to be to live with my brother, who is finishing up UC San Diego. So I went to San Diego City College, worked on my portfolio for about a year, and then got into Art Center. And then I moved down here and have lived in LA ever since.
Got it. All right. So for those who don't know, your background is in motion graphics. Can you tell us about your business journey? How did you become Chris Doe, the motion graphics legend?
Well, okay. I just want to correct one thing. My background is actually in traditional graphic design and packaging of all things. That was the major that I studied at Art Center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Upon graduating, I got really interested into this burgeoning new field called motion graphics. It wasn't called that back then. It was just moving stuff around. Mm-hmm. And I just dove in head first and started to learn about how to do motion design. The interesting thing is one of my very good friends from Art Center happened to be working and dating one of the biggest names in main title design, Kyle Cooper. So she introduced me to Kyle thinking, let's connect two people together. And that's when I really knew, like I got bit hard by the bug and I saw what they were doing. Just around that time, Seven, the main title had just been spreading across all the design radar and just everybody's like, oh my God, what is this thing? And Kyle and his team designed the main titles for Seven.
Wow. Okay. So you know, that's the beginning. But what led you to the place you're at now? You started blind. Mm. You go on to create, I mean, you've been running blind for over 20 years. Go on to create yes. the future. Talk about mm-hmm. that part of your journey.
Okay. And so, of course, like most people who graduate school, you wind up freelancing. And I just had this burning desire in my heart to start a company. It's because I'm headstrong and I'm not a good employee. Jose told me I'm unemployable.
Yeah.
He's like, you just want to do your way. And it's true. So I freelanced for a little bit, but then I started my own company. And it was hard going for the first year and a half because the best way back then to get work was to hire a sales rep. And sales reps, they have a limited roster and they want to pick the horse that's going to win the race almost always. And we're this unknown entity. I didn't have a lot of professional experience to speak of. All of it was self-taught. And of course, they say, well, when you do something big, then we'll represent you.
Yeah.
So how do I do something big if I don't have you to represent me? So a lot of it was just doing little jobs here and there for any friend or friend of a friend that worked at an agency. And we wound up doing projects that literally paid us $500. And we worked all night for weeks to produce a project. So we're talking about not a money-making venture. And the big break came in when one of these contacts that we did a small job for eventually grew and grew until it became the national account for Mitsubishi Motors. When we wound up doing that, that got on everybody's radar. So then finding a rep after that was a lot easier.
Yeah. Have you always taught? Because I know you teach in college and then mm-hmm. you also have the future. So talk to me about how you transitioned. What made you decide I want to teach or give back in that way?
I've always loved teaching. Even when I was in school, when I learned something, one of my friends would come up and it's like, hey, how do you do that? Or people from different majors would ask for help. And I worked in the computer lab and I loved doing that. But I saw something before I even graduated. There were some students who had just graduated and turned around and became a teacher. Mm. Which shocked me a little bit because I was like, what are you doing? She's like, oh, they just hired me. I'm a teacher now. I was thinking, how's that going to work? Because you cannot possibly learn all the things that you were taught. And now you're going to teach the next generation. So this is going to get really bad really fast. So I made a promise to myself that I would not go and teach until I did something with my life, so to speak. And I thought, hard and fast rule, be out of school for at least 5 years before coming back to teach. And almost to the day, like 5 years later, I was invited to teach a title design class for my friend, Michelle Doherty. And I took it over and I kept teaching for 15 years.
Yeah. There was a great quote. I think March 2018, you had an interview on the Neon Moiré show and you said, I listen to teach. What did you mean by that statement?
Mm. Okay, I listen to teach. I don't even remember what I said now. You're like too well researched right now. I listen to teach. So, when I'm trying to figure out how to solve a problem, how to teach more effectively, the best way I know how is to read comments and to listen to what people are saying and where they're struggling. Because if you talk to an Olympic athlete, they're like, how do you run so fast? They're like, I just run. Yeah. They're not really aware of what they're doing, right? Because they were given some God-given talent or just the way they're constructed, their physiology gives them an inherent advantage. So in a similar way, I'm not saying I'm an Olympic athlete, but when it comes to doing what it is that we do as artists, we don't really pay attention like, well, what am I doing today? Like, is this hard or is this easy? We just do. So it isn't until somebody comes to us with a problem and say, well, how did you come up with the idea? Or I'm stuck here. I can't figure this part out. So then I have to ask, like, why are you stuck? What are you thinking about? Tell me about your process. And through that, I become a better teacher. And I think that's why many teachers will say, my students have taught me more than I ever can hope to teach them.
Absolutely. So talk to me about the reason behind creating the future. I'm very interested in that transition period. You're running blind. Mm-hmm. And then what is the impetus for creating the future?
Yeah. And I want to say when it came to launching the future, I was very reluctant to do it. So it's an accidental business that's grown into a movement. Yeah. So I want to be very honest and transparent about that. My good friend Jose was telling me, you know, we got to get you on YouTube. Let's make videos together. Now, making the video part was not hard for us at all because we've been making commercials for multi-billion dollar brands. No problem. I know how to do that. And he's like, no. I want you to be in front of the camera. And that is like, super scary. Like, why would I want to do that? What if I say something that makes me sound like an idiot a-hole? What if I say something that alienates prospective new clients? So all those fears were going on in my head. And maybe I just don't even have anything to say.
Yeah.
And the idea of being captured on video, there's a permanence to it that is very scary and daunting. So I reluctantly agreed. He doesn't take no for an answer. So it wasn't like I could say no. And so the way he made it easy for me was he said, just sit there. Mm-hmm. I'll do all the talking. And he did all the talking.
Yeah.
And then that was like my training wheel. So I'm going, okay, I can say 2 words. The next episode, I could say 10 words. And then, hey, I could form 2 complete sentences. This is pretty good. And so that's like, and I think about what that's done for me, my life, my career, and what we've been able to do. And I would want that for other people. Like, I want to continue that gift so that other people who are having those same fears and anxiety around speaking publicly can get out. And if I could virtually coach everybody, I would.
Yeah. So Jose challenges you to appear on mm-hmm. video. And I think that it was called The mm-hmm. School, correct?
Yes, yeah. It was.
So when did it become something more? When did it become a movement where we're going to teach creative professionals?
Okay. This one may be a little bit harder for me to pinpoint, but I know as I'm doing this with Jose, I'm reading the comments. Again, I'm reading, listening. I was like, wow, this is impacting people's lives. And then I can see the transformation happen within myself in terms of learning things and growing. And then seeing that mirrored in other people, that was really affirming. Like, it's life-affirming stuff. And it started to grow. I mean, we started to get more views. I put more effort into making the videos. And all my fears and apprehension about clients walking away or people getting really upset. Of course, some people got upset. I can't say things in rather bombastic ways. But for the most part, it was very, very positive. And it becomes this thing like, now I don't even want to do client work anymore. So I have to make a choice. And the choice is very difficult because the client work is what keeps the lights on, keeps a roof over our head, and makes sure my kids can stay in private school. Where the future, it feels good inside, yeah. but it's not doing squat for our bank account. So in the early years, I would say the first 2.5 years, we were working at a massive deficit. Thankfully, I had another company, Blind, to back us up because we would not be able to afford the camera, let alone the rooms that we were in. So that's kind of nice where you do a side hustle. So I totally understand that. And it was a real struggle. And we would tell people, you know, I'm not one of these guys who's like an internet marketer. I'm not trying to produce content to try and get rich quick, to teach you something I haven't done. I'm genuinely trying to give as much as possible in the way that I can. And then people started coming out and supporting us. They started donating money. They asked us, the only reason why we have a sustaining member option is that because people are like, how do I give you money? Maybe if enough people did this, we can continue to do this full time. So it's been a little while. It's been like 4.5 years, but we're kind of moving into that space where I can say, like, probably in 2019, the future is 100% full-time commitment from myself and from the entire staff that I have that used to be part of Blind.
That's amazing. And I personally resonate with that story of just having a side hustle. I mean, that's how I started. I had an agency and then, you know, that feeling of there's something here. It's like that thread of not only curiosity, but just that warm feeling of when you're doing work that starts to feed something.
Yes.
So I love that you shared that. Let's talk about the Future Academy.
Okay.
What is it and who is it for? Can you give us an overview?
Yeah, the Future Academy is just what we are calling our courses. And the courses come in different ways. Some are video-based. Some are electronic downloads. For example, PDFs, booklets, kits, toolkits, templates. Things that are tools that we use in our professional practice. And I'll give you one example. We recently launched the legal kit because our community keeps asking us, like, how do I prevent this and this from happening? And how do I make sure the freelancers who work for me don't just steal the work?
Yeah.
How do I protect myself? So of course, we have high-powered attorneys who draft all things for us. And we started to look at, like, what are the most significant documents that we need to produce so that somebody with almost no experience can get a good jump start and not have to drop a ton of money. So this is the power collective bargaining or collective buying. So I pay for attorneys to read and write the documents. And then if we sell enough of them, then it can be amortized across each person. You know, if you hire a good attorney, they're going to be anywhere between $300 to $700 an hour. Mm-hmm. So to draft up all the documents, we're talking about a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
But the legal kit is like $100.
Absolutely.
So yeah, so that's the Future Academy. And it's really for, I think, any aspiring creative entrepreneur. Now, entrepreneur is a person who is going to take charge of their own life and not work for somebody else. So that's a pretty wide net. We mostly focus on people who have the word design in their title somewhere, but we have clients or customers that are architects, that are photographers, that are illustrators. So it's a broad net that we're casting out there.
Did it begin as a full-fledged academy? In other words, did you have several courses that you, or was it just one single course that it's, how did it start?
It's literally one product. It really started with one product called Core. And another product that we added was called Agency in a Box, which is a collection of documents, mm-hmm. legal forms, estimates, case studies, proposals, things like that, that Jose put together. And it was a lot of stuff. It was like everything that you wanted to have, if you could think about this, if you could just be a fly in the wall at a successful agency and just gather all their documents after they left the office, that was what that was. So it just grew from there.
What is the goal of the academy? In other words, what do you want people to be able to do after, let's say they go through all of the courses in the academy? What's the goal?
You're asking a really big question right now. The ultimate goal of the academy is to replace traditional brick and mortar school. Mm-hmm. So we're slowly but surely chipping away at the curriculum that we think a creative person in the 21st century needs to learn. We're far, far away from that, obviously, because if you go to a four-year university, that's a lot of classes and credits that you're taking. So we have a handful of classes, probably about five or six right now, and we're going to keep adding to them. Here's the challenge. Everything is bootstrap, meaning I pay for everything. I don't have any investors. I have a lot of control, but I don't have a lot of money. So each class basically generates enough money for us to launch another class.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of a talk that Elon Musk gave, I think a year and a half ago on stage when he was talking about Tesla as a company. He says, thank you for everybody that bought the sports coupe because that paid for the Model S. And then the Model S paid for the SUV, the Model X, and then the Model 3. And that's kind of where we're at. So thank you very much for each person who's bought a car from us because that allows us to keep doing this. And their whole thing is like, we're not trying to be a transportation company. We're trying to address the global climate change issues that we're all facing. So I look at it the same way. When you buy the lettering course, that pays for the topography course so that we can develop it. And that's how we'll continue to do it. We just take all the money, whatever money there is, and we put it right back into making more content so that somebody can feel at some point in their life, they have a viable alternative to going to traditional brick and mortar school. They can get, I think, a similar, in some cases, a better education for a significantly less amount of money.
Why is that important to you?
It's important to me because I think education, like healthcare, should be a universal right and not a privilege. And unfortunately, we all know this, I think. I don't think I'm going to get a lot of argument from anybody, is that education is probably the fastest and most efficient way for people to change their income level. And so if we say the best schools are for the richest people, well, we're going to build a system that is inequitable.
Yeah.
So the rich and literally get richer and the poor get poorer. So not only were you born in life in a disadvantaged position, now you don't have access to high quality education. I think we need to change that. And I think given the platforms and how we're interconnected via the web, that this can be possible now. It used to be a dream. I would say 20 years ago, this would be a dream. And we would see commercials because, of course, I worked on a lot of commercials, like from AT&T or something like, imagine one day you'll be able to tuck your child in from 3,000 feet away. Imagine taking a class and having never stepped in a classroom. I'm like, ooh, that's a good future I want to imagine. But that was all kind of like hyperbole, like looking into the future, right? But now we are here. And what's really interesting, here's the proof in what I'm saying. I recently did a casting call for Young Guns 2, which is only women under 26 years old. Oh, that's it. And yesterday I was just reviewing all the applicants and we have 37 viable candidates who sent in a video submission and they are from all over the world. It just blows me away because I was expecting mostly people from North America, but actually they were in the minority. Mm-hmm. So we had Europeans, people from Ukraine, a couple people from Australia and New Zealand. So I was like, wow, the reach of this thing is incredible. And the faces and the diverse voices that I'm seeing and hearing, oh, it blows me away.
You know, I want to dig into that. I'm going to go away from my questions right now, you know, because you said you were expecting to receive mostly applicants from North America. Mm-hmm. And I know that you probably get questions just as I get questions from people who are not in North America. Let's say there are people in developing countries who are working hard to figure out how to take advantage of online education to enrich their lives. What do you think are the differences and the things that they have to overcome that are different from, let's say, people in North America? And how do we solve for that as educators?
Okay. That's a very good question. It's a loaded question. And I'm probably going to get in trouble here. So let me just think about how I want to phrase this, okay? I ultimately believe this 100% in my heart. And I think there's a lot of people who are going to listen to this and yell at me afterwards, but I'm going to say it anyways. That learning the tools and the techniques of design making is actually universal. That if I sat in a room and I showed you how to lay things out and the principles of good design, you can learn it. And it doesn't really matter where you're from. So why are people in developing countries having a hard time onboarding clients and getting work in a way that's sustainable to them? And mostly I believe this to be true, is that it's all mindset. So you are a byproduct of the culture, the community, and the parents that brought you into the world. So in some way, whether you're aware of it or not, you've inherited an operating system. Now, this operating system, depending on who your parents were, and this has nothing to do with whether you're in a developing country or not, but who your parents are and what they believe are rules written 30, 50 years ago, depending on how old your parents are. So we know in the last 20 years, the iPhone wasn't even around. So there's things that have radically changed the face of the world, and the operating system that you have is not capable of dealing with the rapid changes that we're going through. So that's the first thing. Most people in developing countries say, well, I can't get work and they pay so little here. You don't understand the culture and community here. They just don't value design. And I say, you're right. You are totally right. Because when you're getting paid $10 a day to work on a job, asking somebody for $2,000 for a logo seems unreasonable. How could they fathom that? And so if you're sitting there in some developing country and you still sit there and say, well, I can't get work here. And it's like, well, it's true. Because the value of just staying alive is more important than the value of creating something that's beautiful. So what we have to do is we have to say, well, why do you sit there and insist on working in a local market when you could easily work with anybody in the world, anywhere? All you have to do is get a .com address. You have to be able to speak or at least write in English and put your work up so that from the outside, nobody can tell the difference. Quality work wins. And I'll give you proof of this right now. So we have three teams of logo therapists, teams of two, and none of them are from the United States. And how did I find any of these people? I found them through their work online.
Yeah. I think that to be completely transparent on my end, I think there are some logistical challenges depending upon the country. And some of them have recently been brought to my attention, you know, and some of those could be certain countries have restrictions on banking. And it's very hard for them to set up a bank account to accept US dollars. And when I talk about those countries, you know, I didn't know this until this year when I started doing some research.
Okay.
Not anything that you can't work around.
Well, no, let's get right into
this. Not anything that you can't work around, but there are logistical things that I think that we as entrepreneurs in the US don't often think about. And that's really the reason behind this question.
Okay. So here's the thing here. I should take a step back and say this. I think through evolution, we are hardwired to spot differences, right? When you're in the Serengeti and then there's a lion that's going to jump out and eat you, you need to be able to say like, that's grass, that's a lion. And we start to notice that really fast. So one of the rules about camouflage is to blend into your environment, right? So we're hardwired, we're trained to spot differences. So when we look at our lives, if I never left my country of origin in Vietnam, I could be sitting there like, well, you know, you're in the US and you do this and this is how I'm different. So what that difference is doing is it's making it okay for you not to tackle the things that you're most afraid of. So we say, well, the banking system is different. Well, yeah, it is. But you know what? I've been able to pay lots of people from all over the world. We figure it out. We get a Venmo account. We get a PayPal thing going. There are ways to do this,
man. Yeah, there definitely are.
Somewhere, somehow, there's a way. So here's the thing. If somebody's going to come back and say, well, Chris, I'm going to do this on purpose. Oh, it's really hard. Well, you know what? The person who's willing to put in the effort will reap the rewards. Of course, it's supposed to be hard. If it weren't hard, everybody and their mother would be a designer making a ton of money. It's not supposed to be easy. Yeah. So there's these roadblocks. And I love this line. I'm going to screw it up from the film Desperate Measures, where I think Michael Keaton is playing the criminal mastermind against Andy Garcia. And he says to him, you don't know about resolve. You don't know where you end and that's where I begin. And that's the voice I hear in my head. Everybody says it can't be done, Chris. Don't go against these things. Don't try to do this. You're stirring it up. Don't go against the machine and the grain. It's not possible. I mean, how many times have I heard that? And then if that's your litmus test for, well, you're right, can't do it. You know, there's a will, there's a way. I mean, I don't want to send cash, but if I need to, I'll box up some money and, you know, maybe the officials to take it. I don't know.
No,
but there's a way.
I think that we both agree that there, you know, where there is a will, there is a way. And so, you know, my motivation behind this whole exploring this side is, you know, when I was studying instructional design, I learned about the digital divide, which is a very real thing. I live in Chicago and I know that resources such as internet and other things that, you know, I take for granted living on the north side of Chicago, but are very different. So what I'm saying is that, yes, it is hard and it should be hard. For some people, it is harder for others. And I think it's important. I think we would be remiss not to address that. And that doesn't mean that you can't figure out a way. It's just simply acknowledging the system.
Right. I agree. So you and I, we already have the best zip code in the world. We have an American address, right? Where there's a lot of economic mobility and in some areas more than others. I understand that, but I'm talking about hardwiring yourself to not look at what makes you less than. I want to focus on what makes you more than. I've been listening to a lot of Tony Robbins, right? And some of the things he says really clearly articulates my thought pattern that nothing in life has meaning except for the meaning you assign to it. So you can say, you know, your parents were unkind to you, but that made you more resilient.
Yeah.
You could say that you didn't have a lot growing up, but that made you hungrier than a person who had everything handed to them. And it's just up to you to decide what kind of lens you want to look at the world. So I'm a big believer in bending reality to suit what makes you more powerful. That's the message I want to send out there, right? So I understand you have, just like I have more opportunities based on where I live and the people I network with, for sure. But it's not something that you cannot overcome. It's not insurmountable. And if we say to you, to each person that's listening to this, chances are in your city or your country, there's a billionaire somewhere there. There's a millionaire. And if you're talking about Aaron Draplin, there's a thousandaire somewhere. Why can't one of those people be you? What makes them so unique? I want to send a message of empowerment, not one of entitlement or just, there's no pity party here.
Yeah.
I know it's brutal, it's harsh, but you know what? I just don't know any other way to succeed. So we can acknowledge it, but I don't want to dwell there.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're in alignment there. All right.
Right.
That was a great chat. Thank you, Chris. Let's get back to talking about the Future Academy.
Okay.
You mentioned that every course that you sell, every sale is reinvested, and then you all create new courses. So I want to talk about your process for course creation. How do you approach creating a new course? Where do you start?
Okay, I'm going to give you all the dirty secrets. And it's going to be really shocking to you. Okay. All right. So if you guys are listening to this, get your pen out. If you want to make a knowledge product, I'm going to tell you how to do it. I do want to predicate what I'm going to say or preface what I'm going to say is that I've been teaching for 15 years. So I have some experience doing this. And I've also been coached by other teachers on how to teach better and immensely fascinated by how to teach better. So I want to consider myself a life learner and a life student. Having said that, let's move that aside. The first thing that you want to do is to look at what you do almost always. And you're like, you know, I've done this 10,000 times before. And you take it for granted that it's super easy for you to do. And then you look into like, okay, what are the five things that allow me to do this? Like, what are the five decisions I'm making so that I can determine if this is good or bad? So Dr. Sam Holtzman at Art Center did the same thing with me. And it's hard to believe this, but I'd been teaching for 10 years before I even thought of this, okay? So he's a faculty advisor at Art Center. So his job is to teach teachers. So he said, Chris, when you're looking at a sequence, a main title sequence, which is what I was teaching, motion graphics, what are the five decisions that you're making when you look at this work to determine if it's good or not? Like, okay. And I'm literally sitting across from him in his office. I'm like, okay, well, the first thing is, I'm asking myself, is this clear or confusing? So if I can't understand this frame that you've designed, I'm done. That frame is dead to me.
Yeah.
And the next frame is, okay, is it clear or confusing? Now, if it's clear, is it dramatic or is it boring? So if it's clear and boring, you got to fix it. And so I would go through each and every step. So these are the five things. Is it clear or confusing? Is it dramatic or boring? Does the sequence make sense? Like when I go 1, 2, 3. Is the sequence correct? Is there a surprise? That's number 4. Meaning if I go through your clear and interesting sequence that makes sense, is there a surprise at the end? Or it's like, I'm going to yawn at the end. There has to be a surprise. And the fifth thing is there anything else that we can do to smooth out the moments from going from shot to shot? Can we build in some transitions? And those are my five things. So if we're talking about typography, it's the same thing. Think about the five things that make for a good design. Lettering, sequential design, anything that you want to teach in life. What are the five things that have to happen for this to be good? If you can distill it down to that, you're off to a really good start. Step number 2. I don't want to just teach out of my butt. So if I'm teaching something, I like to do a little bit more research. I want to be a little bit more informed so that I just don't talk about things I don't know about. So if I'm going to teach a class, which I've done on typography, I bought 6 books on typography, grid system. And I read through them and I started to highlight things. And so I was back filling in things that I do intuitively to make sure that I'm speaking from a platform of knowledge. Did I get it all right? No way. But at least it's not just a bunch of BS.
Yeah.
And then I want to give homework assignments or exercises for people to do so they can practice what they've learned. We've all read great books. A few of us have put what we've read into action. So there's that component to it.
Okay. So that's a great segue into my next question. What are some of the things that you do to make your content more actionable? You mentioned assignments. What does it look like? Walk me through. Let's pick your typography course. What kind of actionable elements are there?
Okay. The typography one's quite easy because I just replicated how I was taught typography. So in class, every week, the instructor would give us the exact same assignment every single week with one new variable. So by the time you get to week 7 or 8, you start to learn how to manipulate that piece of content because it's the same amount of copy, same page dimensions, but he opens one new variable. So essentially, that's what I was able to replicate. And this isn't something that you want to mess with because my instructor, who's British, learned it from Swiss instructors in Basel, Switzerland, and they've been doing great type for decades. So I'm not going to go and muck that up. So all I needed to do was decide what copy do I want to include in the exercise. And so what people do is they change one variable and they keep working on it. So you do, I think, 10 or 15 layouts every single week. The only difference here, because our courses have to be scalable, is I cannot critique your work.
Yeah.
So they can do it, but nobody's going to sit there and say, well, move this over here, change that, and then it's good. That's the only one thing that we can't replicate right now.
Got it. So how do you measure learning and engagement? You know, these are self-paced courses and you just said you're not able to check work. So how do you make sure that students are getting it? What do you have anything in place to figure out if where people are getting stuck and if they're learning and actually applying this stuff?
Not really. Not in any way that's really effective. People do send me layouts, which I'm like, guys, I cannot critique your layout. It's just I don't have the time. And the volume of people asking for this, it's out of control.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, I'll make a comment here or there. But we've also established communities on Facebook, which are free, where you submit your design and peers will review it. And if you participate, hopefully somebody else will participate and give you a critique. So that's all that we can do. Now, here's the one big difference between self-learning and learning through an institution. Is that it removes that check and balance system where somebody's going to be checking in on you. And I think this has to be mostly self-directed. And that's where the cost differential is, right? So if we say, if you go to Art Center, I think it's like $21,000 a semester and you take 5 or 6 classes. So you're talking about at least $4,000 per class.
Yeah.
So if we charge you $159 for typography course, where is that $4,000 coming from? The difference, right? Well, the difference is you have human beings looking at your work, committed to that time, you have the space in which you learn in and all the things that go to support it, not just the room, but the hallways, the library, the electricity, the internet, all those things, the infrastructure. And that's what you're paying for. I have yet to figure out how to give you a $4,000 education for $159. So the new model could be, well, I got to charge you $1,000 now for this class and I'll have TAs critique your work.
Yeah.
And that could be the next tier. But then that starts to go against the whole education for all. Now, I know. For some people, $159 is a lot of money. But trust me, compared to what you'd have to pay for the kind of education you're going to get, it is a bargain. As soon as I move it to $1,000, it now becomes out of reach again for a lot of people.
Mm. So I want to come back to that. But first I want to ask, does teaching design differ from, say, teaching maths in its approach?
Yes.
In your view? And can you talk about that?
Yes. And I think this is the problem with creativity. Let's just take math because math is probably the most straightforward thing. Math has been around for a couple thousand years. So people have been teaching and learning math for a couple thousand years, right? Now, math is really based on logic and rules. If you learn the rules, the formulas, and that's what I remember from all my math classes is once you learn the formula, you can solve the math problem. And what happens is as you go up in school, as you matriculate, you learn more complicated rules until you get into theoretical math or something where you're inventing some crazy stuff. Okay, so A, it's been taught for a long time. It's based on rules and logic. And so it's quite understandable. And it's quite like if you took the class and you have good memory and pattern recognition, you're going to do just fine. When it comes to creative things, we don't know what those rules are just yet. It's like alchemy. Like we don't know how to get there. It's just like math. It's just except we haven't spent as much time trying to decode what makes for good design. Now, here's the thing though. when you give a student a math problem to solve, the answer, the correct answer, I think is always going to be the same. Mm-hmm. That's how a robot can look at like, yes, it's right or wrong. When you look at a piece of design, like if I give everybody the same assignment, even with really tight parameters, the output is totally different from each person to person. So that starts to hint at the problem of kind of a uniform way of teaching or a uniform way of measuring the quality of design. And we will get there someday, but it's going to be a long time. If you take the time it took to develop proper math courses, it's probably going to take that and then some to teach design in that same way.
Yeah, I think one of the most eye-opening things for me, because I came from an academic background of designing college courses, and one of the most eye-opening things for me was when I started interviewing entrepreneurs and from all walks of life, the ones that were teaching something creative like music or writing, it was always a very different, more process-oriented approach. And that was eye-opening. I think when you have creativity in the mix, it can't be this linear, very rigid approach. You have to make space for that creativity to show up and for variety in output. So, you know, I have some thoughts still trying to figure out, but I think that it's an ongoing experiment, which is part of the fun of teaching.
Yeah. But you know, this typography class that I'm teaching I'm teaching the way that I learned, it is pretty structured.
Yeah.
And a high percentage of people who just go through the exercise have gigantic leaps forward in terms of their ability to command type. Because what it does is it removes variables, okay? So literally the assignment is take this body of copy. You can use whatever typeface. Let's say it's Helvetica. And the first parameter that you can do is you can only pick one weight and one point size. The page dimensions stay the same, the amount of copy, and you must use all the copy.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a radically different way of learning design because most of us sit there at the screen and say, what typeface should I pick? How many different point sizes? I can use Photoshop, I can use photography, illustration, I could do so many different things. And the options is what fights against our learning. So when you're restricted down to like one point size, here's Helvetica, one weight, make something interesting. So those are the things where it's getting close to a math problem now where we look at the layouts across the room and you can quite easily pick out the ones that are working well. And it's not quite universal, but I would say 75 to 80% of the people would agree those are the best layouts.
Yeah.
If you gave people red dots and they walked around the room, they would probably put the red dots on a majority, you know, like they would be a few anomalies. And then what happens is over time, we would train students to all pick the same thing because now they realize what is good and what's not good. So it's just a process. So typography in that way, I think, has been figured out in terms of how to teach it, but it's also had probably the longest amount of time in terms of people thinking about how to teach it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think that you have to have structure. You have to have a skeleton. I mean, if you think about writing, there's always that structural component for how to compose an essay, let's say.
Right.
But, you know, as you continue to iterate and advance, then you have more room to put your special sauce in the mix, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Okay.
And some of the best writers don't follow the rules.
Absolutely. But they know them.
Here's the thing.
They know them very well.
They know them. They usually know them, right? And that's also like a lot of creatives who are like, I don't know any rules. I'm just going to make stuff. And it's like a thousand monkeys trying to write Shakespeare. You could hit it.
Yeah.
Could you do it again? Probably not.
Yeah.
So it's better to kind of have some structure to start to train your eye and your mind as to the decisions that you're making, why you're making them, and what makes for what most people would consider good or bad design. And from there, you can expand out and experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So before we get to the final three questions, you talked about your Facebook group. And I want to come back because I know community is something that you speak on and you feel strongly about. What role do you think community plays in education?
I think it's a necessary component because I think there's four pillars to happiness, perceived control, perceived progress, feeling like you belong to community and a power greater than you. So if we only deliver two things, we're not doing a good job. So we need to feel like we belong to community. We're social creatures, human beings are. And I think what's interesting is, at least in a classroom environment, is when you see Bobby or Mary do something weird or amazing, you learn from that. You can learn vicariously through them. And I think that's great. So sometimes too, you're just too close to the problem and you think, oh my God, this is amazing. And you bring it into class or into community. And they either affirm that or they're like, oh, no, look at these other layouts. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So we're very contextual learners, right? Like I was reading a book from Blair Enns and he says, there is no way for us to look at anything without comparing it to something else. So if you present a budget to a client, they can't tell if that's high or low. So what they do is they get other bids and they're like, ooh, what a bargain. Or, oh my gosh, he or she is trying to steal from us. So that's how we do it. So that's why I think community is very important. And I just think that just knowing that somebody else is out there doing what you're trying to do and they struggle just like you and bleed just like you, it's kind of comforting.
Yeah, I agree. Especially with online learning, you know, being an entrepreneur, especially if you are building a business online, can be a very lonely road. And
yeah,
if you're trying to learn something, just having other people who are on the journey with you, and their journey might be a little different, but they're on the same path, rather. It's so comforting. And then you have the added benefit of, you know, steel sharpens steel. So you have other people who are working towards some of the same goals that you have and are going to challenge you. So I think it's really integral to have community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. We are down to the final three questions, Chris. The first one is easy. What is next for you? Anything exciting coming up?
Yes. The most exciting thing is we're throwing a party/meetup for future fans in our community, talking about community, in our space. Now, it's hard to believe this, but we've been in business for over 23 years. We've never thrown a party before where we've invited people we don't know. So this is going to be a test for lots of things. My OCD, just all control issues, cleanliness, everything. So we're actually throwing a party and we initially announced that 75 people can come. And then within the first 2 days, it filled up. So we started getting some angry email notifications like, hey man, I missed it by like, what happened? Like, is there any exceptions? So the gang had a meeting and they talked it over. Like, hey Chris, we can open it up. I'm like, okay. So we opened up to 150 and now all kinds of people are jumping in. So we shall see. I don't want 150 people to show up because it's too many people.
Yeah.
But if 100 people showed up, I think it'd be super cool. I'm very excited about that. And the entire team is busy organizing a space, doing decorations and party planning, food, all kinds of party games and things that we're going to give away. So I'm really excited about that. And it's happening next Thursday, December 3rd.
That's really cool. Yeah, it's going to be fun. You having a DJ?
Of course. No, I can't reveal everything, but we're going to do a segment called Hidden Talent, where I'm going to ask the community a few questions about future members' secret hidden talent. And then they can guess. And whoever guesses the most correct answers will win a prize. So if I say, this person used to do this in high school and sing on the choir team and sang this song, who is this person? And then they can guess. And then I would call that person onto stage with me and say, okay. And that, and the, will the real person kind of come forward? And then they come up and they're going to have to sing.
Oh.
Or they're going to have, and this person used to beatbox, or this person used to do XYZ. And they guess. And of course, they're going to come up and do that. So I think we're going to have a really good time. My whole mission with the party planning committee is that I want to break down the barriers of the formality. Like I know on screen, I come across a certain way. I'm like, oh, this is what you got to do in XYZ. This is a time for us just to be just super weird and normal so that people are like, oh,
yeah,
there is a little soul behind the robot.
He's a real person. Mm-hmm.
Not a big soul, but you know, there's something there, right? Because people always say to me when they meet me, like, oh, you're a little different than I expected. I'm like, what did you expect? A Martian? Like, no, for you to just chop me down and just size me up in one glance. I'm like, no, I'm just a normal person. That's just a person I play on TV.
Literally. All right. Where can people find out more about you and your work, Chris?
We try to make it really easy for people to find us. The best place is probably YouTube. So if you go to youtube.com, you can look us up at The Future Is Here, no space. And we're also on Facebook. Like almost 80,000 people are following us on Facebook. Again, The Future Is Here on Twitter and Instagram. It's the same name, The Future Is Here. Future is spelled without an E, so F-U-T-U-R. And I'm Chris Doe, and you can find me also. And we create lots of content. So if you poke around, you'll find very different things on different platforms.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will be sure to link to YouTube and all of those places in the show notes. Last question. Mm-hmm. What's your why? Why do you get up and do this work every day?
My why is to make a difference on this planet. I'm on a mission to educate the world. And there is not enough hours in the day for me to accomplish that mission. So I have to employ and use the collective resources of this global community that we built to help me further that mission.
Chris, thank you so much for being on the show. I know that this is going to be great for people to listen to, and our extra little bonus conversation around the digital divide was fun as well. So thank you for being here.
I had a good time. Thanks for having me.
Hey, what's up, family? Thank you so much for taking time out to listen to my interview with Christo. I want to give a big shout out to Chris for just coming on the show, keeping it real, sharing his story, and all of those nuggets of wisdom that he has. It was just a pleasure talking with him. So, speaking of talking with Chris, we did not end there. As you probably can tell, Chris and I, we enjoy talking with each other, and we kind of got into a bonus segment. Not kind of, we absolutely recorded a bonus segment for you where we talked about some really important things that I want you to check out. So the first thing that Chris shared was how he went from having zero business skills to having to get up to speed really quickly when he started his agency. Definitely want to check out the segment for that alone. The other thing we talked about was just how important it is for creative professionals to study business and marketing and some things that you can do to kickstart that if you're weak in that area. And we also, most importantly, talked about what you need to do to get out of your comfort zone, why that is important. So check out the bonus segment. Chris also shared his vision for the future of entrepreneurship. If you want to grab the bonus segment, you can get it by going over to get.zencourses.co/extra. Once again, that is get.zencourses.co/extra. Pop in your email address and you will receive an email with a link to check out that bonus segment. So be sure to do that because there was a lot of great stuff that Chris and I discussed. All right, my friends, that is my time. Remember, before you can level up your course, you must first level up your mind. As always, thank you for hanging out with me for another great episode. I do not take it for granted. I am Janelle Allen, and this has been Level Up Your Course. Peace.